Had he become the bad people he'd learned about in youth? Or had he been lied to? It hurt his head to consider, but here he was, leading a recreation of something awful. And yet, it felt so right, so necessary. What if that former clash had felt the same? Had felt the same in the breasts of the men and women who'd waged it. 19. Methinks I see thee, now thou art so low, as one dead in the bottom of a tomb. It would take 10 lifetimes to read all these. Juliet looked up from the pile of scattered tins and stacks of thick books. There was more to marvel at in their text-heavy pages than in any of the children's books of her youth. Solo turned from the stove where he was heating soup and boiling water. He waved a dripping metal spoon at the scattered mess she'd made.
"I don't think they were meant to be read," he told her. "At least, not like I've been reading them front to back."
He touched his tongue to the spoon, then stuck it back in the pot and stirred.
"Everything's out of order. It's more like a backup to the backup."
"I don't know what that means," Juliet admitted. She looked down at her lap where pictures of animals called butterflies filled the pages. Their wings were comically bright. She wondered if they were the size of her hands or the size of people. She had yet to find any sense of scale for the beasts.
The servers, Solo said. "What did you think I meant? The backup?"
He sounded flustered. Juliet watched him busy about the stove, his movements jerky and manic, and realized she was the one cloistered away and ignorant, not him. He had all these books, decades of reading history, the company of ancestors she could only imagine. What did she have as her experience? A life in a dark hole with thousands of fellow ignorant savages? She tried to remember this as she watched him dig a finger in his ear and then inspect his fingernail. "The backup of what, exactly?" she finally asked, almost afraid of the cryptic answers to come. Solo found 2 bowls. He began wiping one out with the fabric in the belly of his coveralls.
The backup of everything," he said. All that we know, all that ever was."
He set the bowls down and adjusted a knob on the stove.
Follow me," he said, waving his arm. "I'll show you."
Juliet closed the book and slotted it into its tin. She rose and followed Solo out of the room and into the next one.
"Don't mind the mess,"
he said, gesturing at the small hill of trash and debris piled up against one wall. It looked like 1,000 empty cans of food and smelled like 10,000. Juliet wrinkled her nose and fought the reflex to gag. Solo seemed unaffected. He stood beside a small wooden desk and flipped through diagrams hanging from the wall on enormous sheets of paper.
"Where is the one I want?
He wondered aloud.
"What are these?" Juliet asked, entranced.
She saw one that looked like a schematic of the silo, but unlike any they'd had in mechanical. Solo turned. He had several sheets flopped over one shoulder, his body practically disappearing between the layers of them.
"Maps," he said. "I want to show you how much is out there. You'll shit yourself."
He shook his head and muttered something to himself.
Sorry, didn't mean to say that."
Juliet told him it was fine. She held the back of her hand to her nose, the stench of rotting food intolerable.
"Oh, here it is! Here it is! Hold this end!"
Solo held out the corner of 6 sheets of paper. He took the other side, and they lifted them away from the wall. Juliet felt like pointing out the grommets on the bottom of the maps and how there were probably sticks or hooks around here somewhere for propping them up, but held her tongue. Opening her mouth just made the smell of the rotting cans worse.
"This is us," Solo said.
He pointed to a spot on the paper. Dark, squiggly lines were everywhere. It didn't look like a map or schematic of anything Juliet had ever seen. It looked like children had drawn it. Hardly a straight line existed anywhere.
"What's this supposed to show?" she asked.
"Borders! Land!"
Solo ran his hands over one uninterrupted shape that took up nearly a third of the drawing.
"This is all water," he told her.
"Where?" Juliet's arm was getting tired of holding up her end of the sheet. The smell and the riddles were getting to her. She felt a long way from home. The thrill of survival was in danger of being replaced with the depression of a long and miserable existence looming for years and years before her.
"Out there, covering the land."
Solo pointed vaguely at the walls. He narrowed his eyes at Juliet's confusion.
"The silo, this silo, would be as big around as a single hair on your head."
He patted the map.
"Right here, all of them. Maybe all of us left. No bigger than my thumb."
He placed a finger in a knot of lines. Juliet thought he seemed sincere. She leaned closer to see better, but he pushed her back.
Let these go,
he said. He slapped at her hand, holding the corners of paper. He smoothed the map against the wall.
"This is us."
He indicated one of the circles on the top sheet. Juliet eyeballed the columns and rows, figured there were 4 dozen or so of them.
"Silo 17.
He slid his hand up.
"Number 12. This is 8, and silo 1 up here."
"No." Juliet shook her head and reached for the desk, her legs weak.
"Yes, silo 1. You're probably from 16 or 18. Do you remember how far you walked?"
She grabbed the small chair and pulled it out. Sat down heavily.
How many hills did you cross?"
Juliet didn't answer. She was thinking about the other map and comparing the scales. What if Solo was right? What if there were 50 or so silos and all of them could be covered by a thumb? What if Lucas had been right about how far away the stars were? She needed something to crawl inside, something to cover her. She needed some sleep.
"I once heard from Silo 1, Solo said, "a long time ago. Not sure how well any of those others are doing."
"Wait." Juliet sat up straight. "What do you mean you heard from them?" Solo didn't turn from the map. He ran his hands from one circle to another, a childlike expression on his face.
"They called. Checking in."
He looked away from the map and her, toward the far corner of the room.
"We didn't talk for long. I didn't know all the procedures. They weren't happy."
"Okay, but how did you do this? Can we call someone now? Was it a radio? Did it have a little antenna, a small black pointy thing?"
Juliet stood and crossed to him, grabbed his shoulder and turned him around. How much did this man know that could help her but that she couldn't get out of him? "Solo, how did you talk to them?"
Through the wire, he said.
He cupped his hands and covered his ears with them.
"You just talk in it."
"You need to show me," she said.
Solo shrugged. He flipped up a few of the maps again, found the one he wanted, and pressed the others against the wall. It was the schematic of the silo she had seen earlier. A side-on view of it divided into thirds, each third side by side. She helped him hold the other sheets out of the way.
"Here are the wires. They run every which way."
He traced thick branches of lines that ran from the exterior walls and off the edges of the paper. They were labeled with minuscule print. Juliet leaned closer to read. She recognized many of the engineering marks.
"These are for power," she said, pointing at the lines with the jagged symbols above them.
"Yep," Solo said. "We don't get our own power anymore. Borrow it from others, I think. All automatic."
"You get it from others?"
Juliet felt her frustration rise. How many crucial things did this man know that he considered trifling?
"Anything else you want to add?" she asked him. "Do you have a flying suit that can whisk me back to my silo? Or are there secret passages beneath all the floors so we can just stroll there as easy as we like?"
Solo laughed and looked at her like she was crazy.
No, he said. Then it would be one seed, not many. One bad day would ruin us all. Besides, the diggers are dead. They buried them.
He pointed at a nook, a rectangular room jutting off from the edge of mechanical. Juliet peered closer. She recognized every floor of the down deep at a glance, but this room wasn't supposed to exist.
What do you mean, the diggers?
The machines that remove the dirt, you know, that made this place.
He ran his hand down the length of the silo.
Too heavy to move, I guess, so they poured the walls right over them.
Do they work? Juliet asked. An idea formed. She thought of the mines, of how she'd helped excavate rock by hand. She thought of the sort of machine that could dig out an entire silo, wondered if it could be used to dig between them.
Solo clicked his tongue.
No way. Nothing down there does. All toast. Besides...
He chopped his hand partway up the down deep. There's flooding up to... He turned to Juliet.
Wait, are you wanting out? To go somewhere?
He shook his head in disbelief. I want to go home, Juliet said. His eyes widened.
Why would you go back? They sent you away, didn't they? You'll stay here. We don't want to leave.
He scratched his beard and shook his head side to side. Someone has to know about all of this, Juliet told him. All these other people out there, all that space beyond, the people in my silo need to know.
People in your silo already do, he said.
He studied her quizzically, and it dawned on Juliet that he was right. She pictured where they currently stood in this silo. They were in the heart of IT, deep inside the fortress room of the mythical servers, below the servers in a hidden passage, hidden probably even from the people who had access to the innermost kernels of the silo's mysteries. Someone in her own silo did know. He had helped keep these secrets for generations, had decided, alone and without input from anyone, what they should and should not know. It was the same man who had sent Juliet to her death. A man who had killed who knew how many more.
Tell me about these wires, Juliet said. How do you talk to the other silo? Give me every detail.
Why?
Solo asked, seemingly shrinking before her. His eyes were wet with fear.
Because, she said, I have someone I very much wish to call.
20. This day's black fate on more days doth depend. This but begins the woe others must end. The waiting was interminable. It was the long silence of itchy scalps and trickling sweat, the discomfort of weight on elbows, of backs bent, of bellies flat against an unforgiving conference table. Lucas peered down the length of his fearsome rifle and through the conference room's shattered glass window. Little fragment jewels remained in the side of the jamb like transparent teeth. Lucas could still hear, ringing in his ears, the incredible bang from Sims's gun that had taken out the glass. He could still smell the acrid scent of gunpowder in the air, the looks of worry on the faces of the other techs. The destruction had seemed so unnecessary. All this preparation, the toting of massive black guns out of storage, the interruption of his talk with Bernard, news of people coming from the down deep, it all made little sense. He checked the slide on the side of the rifle and tried to remember the 5 minutes of instruction he'd been given hours earlier. There was a round in the chamber. The gun was cocked. More bullets waited patiently in the clip. And the boys in security gave him a hard time for his tech jargon. Lucas's vocabulary had exploded with new terms. He thought about the rooms beneath the servers, the pages and pages of the order, the rows of books he'd only gotten a glimpse of. His mind sagged under the weight of it all. He spent another minute practicing his sighting, looking down the barrel and lining up the small cross in the tiny circle. He aimed at the cluster of conference chairs that had been rolled into an obstructing jumble by the door. For all he knew, they would be waiting like this for days, and nothing would ever happen. It had been a while since any porter had brought an update on what was going on below. For practice, he gently slid his finger into the guard and against the trigger. He tried to get comfortable with the idea of pulling that lever, of fighting the upward kick Sims had told him to expect. Bobby Milner, a shadow no more than 16, made a joke beside him, and Sims told them both to shut the fuck up. Lucas didn't protest being included in the admonishment. He glanced over at the security gate where a bristle of black barrels poked through the stanchions and over the metal duty desk. Peter Billings, the new silo sheriff, was over there fiddling with his small gun. Bernard stood behind the sheriff, doling out instructions to his men. Bobby Milner shifted his weight beside Lucas and grunted, trying to get more comfortable. Waiting. More waiting. They were all waiting. Of course, had Lucas known what was coming, he wouldn't have minded. He would have begged to wait there forever. Knox led his group through the 60s with just a few stops for water, a pause to secure their packs and tighten their laces. They passed several curious porters with overnight deliveries who prodded for details about where they were heading, about the blackouts. Each porter left unhappy, and hopefully empty-headed. Peter had been right. The stairwell was singing. It vibrated with the march of too many feet. Those who lived above were generally moving upward, away from the blackouts and toward the promise of power, of warm food and hot showers. Meanwhile, Knox and his people mobilized behind them to squelch a different kind of power. At 56, they had their first spot of trouble. A group of farmers stood outside the hydroponic farm, lowering a cluster of power cables over the railing, presumably toward the small group they had seen the last landing down. When they spotted the blue coveralls of Mechanical, one of the farmers called out, "Hey, we keep you fed, why can't you keep the juice on?"
"Talk to IT," Mark replied from the front of the queue. "They're the ones blowing fuses, we're doing what we can."
"Well, do it faster," the farmer said. "I thought we just had a rat-damn power holiday to prevent this nonsense."
"Oh, we'll have it by lunchtime," Shirley told them.
Knox and the others caught up with the head of the group, creating a jam by the landing.
"The faster we get up there, the faster you'll get your juice," Knox explained.
He tried to hold his concealed gun casually, like it was any other tool.
"Well, how about giving us a hand with this tap, then? They've had power on 57 for most of the morning. We'd like enough to get our pumps cranking."
He indicated the trunk of wires coiling over the railing. Knox considered this. What the man was asking was technically illegal. Calling him out on it would mean delays, but telling him to go ahead might look suspicious. He could sense McLean's group several levels up, waiting on them. Pace and timing were everything.
"Well, I can spare two of my men to help out, just as a favor, as long as it doesn't get back to me that Mechanical had shit to do with this."
"Oh, like I care," the farmer said. "I just want the water moving."
"Shirley, you and Courtney give them a hand. Catch up when you can."
Shirley's mouth dropped open. She begged with her eyes for him to reconsider.
"Get going,"
he told her. Mark came to her side. He lifted his wife's pack and handed her his multi-tool. She begrudgingly accepted it, glowered at Knox a moment longer, then turned to go, not saying a word to him or her husband. The farmer let go of the cables and took a step toward Knox.
"Hey, I thought you said you'd lend me two of—"
Knox leveled a glare harsh enough to make the man pause.
"Do you want the best I got?"
he asked.
"Because you got it."
The farmer lifted his palms and backed away. Courtney and Shirley could already be heard stomping their way below to coordinate with the men on the lower landing.
"Let's go,"
Nock said, hitching up his pack. The men and women of mechanical and supply lurched forward once more. They left behind a group of farmers on Landing 56, who watched the long column wind its way upward. Whispers rose as the power cables were lowered. Powerful forces were merging over these people's heads, bad intentions coming together and heading for something truly awful. And anyone with eyes and ears could tell, some kind of reckoning was coming. There was no warning for Lucas, no countdown. Hours of quiet anticipation, of insufferable nothingness, simply erupted into violence. Even though he had been told to expect the worst, Lucas felt like the waiting so long for something to happen just made it a fiercer surprise when it finally did. The double doors of Landing 34 blew open. Solid steel peeled back like curls of paper. The sharp ring made Lucas jump, his hand slip off the stock of his rifle. Gunfire erupted beside him, Bobby Milner shooting at nothing and screaming in fear. Maybe excitement. Sims was yelling impossibly over the roar. When it died down, something flew through the smoke, a canister, bouncing toward the security gate. There was a terrible pause, and then another explosion, like a blow to the ears. Lucas nearly dropped his gun. The smoke by the security gate couldn't quite fog the carnage. Pieces of people Lucas had known came to a sick rest in the entrance hall of IT. The people responsible began to surge through before he could take stock, before he could become fearful of another explosion occurring right in front of him. The rifle beside him barked again, and this time Sims didn't yell. This time, several other barrels partook. The people trying to push through the chairs tumbled into them instead, their bodies shaking as if pulled by invisible strings, arcs of red like hurled paint flying from their bodies. More came. A large man with a throaty roar. Everything moved so slowly. Lucas could see his mouth part, a yell in the center of a burly beard, a chest as wide as two men. He held a rifle at his waist. He fired at the ruined security station. Lucas watched Peter Billings spin to the floor, clutching his shoulder. Bits of glass shivered from the window frame in front of Lucas as barrel after barrel erupted across the conference table, the shattered window seeming insignificant now. A prudent move. The hail of bullets hit the man unseen. The conference room was an ambush, a side-on attack. The large man shook as some of the wildfire got lucky. His beard sagged open. His rifle was cracked in half. A shiny bullet between his fingers. He tried to reload. The guns of IT loosed their own bullets too fast to count. Levers were held, and springs and gunpowder did the rest. The giant man fumbled with his rifle, but never got it reloaded. He tumbled into the chairs, sending them crashing across the floor. Another figure appeared through the door. A tiny woman. Lucas watched her down the length of his barrel, saw her turn and look right at him, the smoke from the explosion drifting toward her, her gray hair flowing like more of it wrapped in a halo around her. He could see her eyes. He had yet to shoot his gun, had watched, jaw slack, as the fighting took place. The woman bent her arm back and made to throw something his way. Lucas pulled the trigger. His rifle flashed and lurched. In the time it took, the long and terrible time it took for the bullet to cross the room, he realized it was just an old woman holding something. A bomb. Her torso spun and her chest blossomed red. The object fell. There was another awful wait. More attackers appearing, screaming in anger until an explosion blew the chairs and the people among them apart. Lucas wept while a second surge made a futile attempt. He wept until his clip was empty, wept as he fumbled for the clasp, shoved a spare into the butt, the salt bitter on his lips as he drew back that bolt and let loose with another menacing hail of metal. So much stouter and quicker than the flesh it met. 21. I have seen the day that I have worn a visor and could tell a whispering tale. Bernard woke to shouting, to his eyes burning from the smoke, his ears ringing with a long-ago blast. Peter Billings was shaking his shoulders, yelling at him, a look of fright in his wide eyes and soot-stained brow. Blood stained his coveralls in a wide, rust-colored pool.
Sir, can you hear me?
Bernard pushed Peter's hand away and tried to sit up. He groped about his body, looking for anything bleeding or broken. His head throbbed. His hand came away from his nose, wet with blood.
What happened?
He groaned. Peter crouched by his side. Bernard saw Lucas standing just behind the sheriff, rifle on his shoulder, peering toward the stairwell. There was shouting in the distance and the patter of gunfire.
"We've got 3 men dead," Peter said. "A few wounded. Sims led a half a dozen into the stairwell. They got it a lot worse than us, a lot worse."
Bernard nodded. He checked his ears, was surprised they weren't bleeding as well. He dotted his sleeve with blood from his nose and patted Peter on the arm. He nodded over his shoulder.
"Get Lucas," he said.
Peter frowned but nodded. He spoke with Lucas, and the young man knelt by Bernard.
"Are you okay?"
Lucas asked. Bernard nodded.
"Stupid. Didn't know they'd have guns. I should have guessed about the bombs."
"Take it easy."
He shook his head.
"I shouldn't have had you here. It's dumb. Could have been us both."
"Well, it was neither of us, sir. We've got 'em running down the stairwell. I think it's over."
Bernard patted his arm.
"Get me to the server," he said. "We'll need to report this."
Lucas nodded. He seemed to know just the server Bernard meant. He helped Bernard to his feet, an arm around his back. Peter Billings frowning as the two of them staggered down the smoky hallway together.
"Not good,"
Bernard told Lucas, once they were away from the others.
"But we won, right?"
"Not yet. The damage won't be contained here. Not today. You'll have to stay below a while."
Bernard grimaced and tried to walk alone.
"Can't risk something happening to us both."
Lucas seemed unhappy about this. He entered his code into the great door, pulled out his ID, wiped someone else's blood off it and his hand, then swiped it through the reader.
"I understand," he finally said.
Bernard knew he'd picked the right man. He left Lucas to close the heavy door while he made his way to the rearmost server. He staggered once and fell against number 8, catching himself and resting a moment until the wooziness went away. Lucas caught up before he got to the back of the room, was pulling his copy of the master key out of his coveralls. Bernard rested against the wall while Lucas opened the server. He was still too shaken up to notice the flashing code on the server's front panel. His ears were too full of a false ringing to notice the real one.
"What's that mean?" Lucas said. "That noise."
Bernard looked at him quizzically.
"A fire alarm?"
Lucas pointed up at the ceiling. Bernard finally heard it as well. He swam toward the back of the server as Lucas opened the last lock, pushed the young man out of the way.
What were the chances? Did they already know?
Bernard's life had become unhinged in 2 short days. He reached inside the cloth pouch, grabbed the headset, and pulled it over his tender ears. He pushed the jack into the slot labeled 1 and was surprised to hear a beep. The line was ringing. He was making a call. He pulled the jack out hurriedly, canceling the call, and saw that the light above 1 wasn't blinking. The light above 17 was. Bernard felt the room spin. A dead silo was calling him? A survivor? After all these years? With access to the servers? His hand trembled as he guided the jack into the slot. Lucas was asking something behind him, but Bernard couldn't hear anything through the headphones.
Hello? He croaked. Hello? Is anyone there?
Hello? A voice said. Bernard adjusted his headphones. He waved for Lucas to shut the fuck up. His ears were still ringing, his nose bleeding into his mouth.
Who is this?
He asked.
Can you hear me?
I hear you, the voice said. Is this who I think it is?
Who the fuck is this? Bernard sputtered. How do you have access to?
You sent me out, the voice said. Is this Bernard? You sent me to die. Bernard slumped down, his legs numb. The cord on the headphones uncoiled and nearly pulled the cups from his head. He clutched the phones and fought to place this voice. Lucas was holding him by the armpits, keeping him from collapsing to his back. Are you there? The voice asked. Do you know who this is?
No,
he said. But he knew. It was impossible, but he knew. You sent me to die, you fuck.
You knew the rules, Bernard cried, yelling at a ghost. You knew.
Shut up and listen, Bernard. Just shut the fuck up and listen to me very carefully. Bernard waited. He could taste the copper of his own blood in his mouth. I'm coming for you. I'm coming home, and I'm coming to clean. The world is not thy friend, nor the world's law. Villain and he may be many miles asunder, and all these woes shall serve for sweet discourses in our time to come. He that is struck in blind cannot forget the precious treasure of his eyesight lost. One fire burns out another's burning. One pain is lessened by another's anguish. The tragic history of Romeus and Juliet. Wool, Part 5. The Stranded. 1. Silo 18. Mark stumbled down the great stairway, his hand sliding against the cool railing, a rifle tucked under his arm, his boots slipping in blood. He could barely hear the screams all around him, the wails from the wounded as they were half-dragged down the steps, the horrified cries from the curious crowds on every landing who witnessed their passage, or the shouts of promised violence from the men chasing him and the rest of his mechanics from level to level. The ringing in his ears drowned out most of the noise. It was the blast, the god-awful blast. Not the one that had peeled open the doors of IT. He had been ready for that one, had hunkered down with the rest. And it wasn't the second bomb, the one Knox had lobbed deep into the heart of their enemy's den. It was the last one. The one he didn't see coming. The one that spilled from the hands of that small gray woman from supply. McLean's bomb. It had gone off right in front of him. Had taken his hearing as it took her life. And Knox, that stout and unmovable head of mechanical, his boss, his good friend, gone. Mark hurried down the steps, wounded and afraid. He was a long way from the safety of the down deep, and he desperately wanted to find his wife. He concentrated on this rather than the past, tried not to think of the explosion that had taken his friends, had wrecked their plans, had engulfed any chance at justice. Muffled shots rang out from above, followed by the piercing zing of bullets striking steel. Only steel, thank God. Mark stayed away from the outer railing, away from the aim of the shooters who hounded them from the landings above with their smoothly firing rifles. The good people of mechanical and supply had been running and fighting for over a dozen levels. Mark silently begged the men above to stop, to give them a chance to rest, but the boots and the bullets kept coming. Half a level later, he caught up to three members of supply, the one in the middle wounded and being ported, arms draped over shoulders, blood dotting the backs of their yellow coveralls. He yelled at them to keep moving, couldn't hear his own voice, could just feel it in his chest. Some of the blood he was slipping in was his own. With his injured arm tight against his chest, his rifle cradled in the crook of his elbow, Mark kept his other hand on the railing to keep from tumbling headfirst down the steep stairwell. There were no allies behind him, none still alive. After the last shootout, he had sent the others ahead, had barely gotten away himself. And yet they kept coming, tireless. Mark would pause now and then, fumble with the unreliable ammunition, chamber a shot and fire wildly up the stairwell, just to do something, to slow them down. He stopped to take a breath, leaned out over the railing, and swung his rifle toward the sky. The next round was a dud. The bullets buzzing back at him weren't. Huddling against the stairwell's central post, he took the time to reload. His rifle wasn't like theirs. One shot at a time, and difficult to aim. They had guns like he'd never heard of, shots coming as fast as a frightened pulse. He moved toward the railing and checked the landing below, could see curious faces through a cracked doorway, fingers curled around the edge of the steel jamb. This was it. Landing 42, the last place he'd seen his wife.
"Shirley!"
Calling her name, he staggered down a quarter turn until he was level with the landing. He kept close to the interior, out of sight from his pursuers, and searched the shadowed faces.
"My wife!"
he yelled across the landing, a hand cupped to his cheeks, forgetting that the incredible ringing was only in his ears, not theirs.
"Where is she? Where is she?"
A mouth moved in the dark crowd. The voice was a dull and distant drone. Someone else pointed down. The faces cringed, the cracked door twitched shut as another ricochet screamed out. The stairway shook with all the frightened boots below and the chasing ones above. Mark eyed the illicit power cables draped over the railing and remembered the farmers attempting to steal electricity from the level below. He hurried down the stairs, following the thick cords, desperate to find Shirley. One level down, positive that his wife would be inside, Mark braved the open space of the landing and rushed across. He threw himself against the doors. Shots rang out. Mark grabbed the handle and tugged, shouting her name to ears as deaf as his own. The door budged, was being held fast with the sinewy restraint of unseen arms. He slapped the glass window, leaving a pink palm print, and yelled for them to open up, to let him in. Eager bullets rattled by his feet. One of them left a scar down the face of the door. Crouching and covering his head, he scurried back to the stairwell. Mark forced himself to move downward. If Shirley was inside, she might be better off. She could strip herself of incriminating gear, blend in until things settled down. If she were below, he needed to hurry after her. Either way, down was the only direction. At the next landing, he caught up with the same three members of supply. The wounded man was sitting on the decking, eyes wide. The other two were tending to him, blood on their sides from supporting his weight. One of the supply workers was a woman Mark vaguely recognized from the march up. There was a cold fire in her eyes as Mark paused to see if they needed help.
"I can carry him,"
he shouted, kneeling by the wounded man. The woman said something. Mark shook his head and pointed to his ears. She repeated herself, lips moving in exaggeration, but Mark wasn't able to piece it together. She gave up and shoved at his arm, pushing him away. The wounded man clutched his stomach, a red stain ballooning out from his abdomen all the way to his crotch. His hands clasped something protruding there, a small wheel spinning on the end of a steel post, the leg of a chair. The woman pulled a bomb from her satchel, one of those pipes that promised so much violence. It was solemnly passed to the wounded man, who accepted it, his knuckles white, his hands trembling. The two members of supply pulled Mark away, furniture sprouting from his oozing stomach. The shouts sounded distant, but he knew they were nearby. They were practically in his ear. He found himself yanked backwards, transfixed by the vacant stare on the face of this doomed and wounded man. His eyes locked onto Mark's. The man held the bomb away from himself, fingers curled around that terrible cylinder of steel, a grim clench of teeth jutting along his jawline. Mark glanced up the stairwell where the boots were finally gaining on them, coming into view. Black and bloodless, this tireless and superior enemy. They came down the dripping trail Mark and the others had left behind, coming for them with their ammo that never failed. He stumbled down the stairwell backwards, half-dragged by the others, one hand on the railing, eyes drifting to the swinging door opening behind the man they'd left behind. A young face appeared there, a curious boy, rushing out to see. A tangle of adult hands scrambled to pull him back. Mark was hauled down the stairs, too far down the curving stairs to see what happened next. But his ears, as deadened as they were, caught the popping and zinging of gunfire, and then a blast, a roaring explosion that shook the great stairwell, that knocked him and the others down, slamming him against the railing. His rifle clattered toward the edge. Mark lunged for it. He grabbed it before it could escape and go tumbling into space. Shaking his head, stunned, he pushed himself up to his hands and knees and managed to rise slowly to his feet. Senseless, he staggered forward down the shuddering steps, the treads beneath his feet ringing and vibrating as the silo around them all continued its spiral into dark madness. 2. Silo 18. The first moment of true rest came hours later at supply, on the upper edge of the down deep. There was talk of holding there, of setting up some kind of barrier, but it wasn't clear how the entire stairway could be blocked to include the open space between the railing and the concrete cylinder beyond. This was the gap where the singing bullets lived, a place where jumpers were known to meet their ends, and where their enemy could surely find some way to scamper down. Mark's hearing had improved during the last leg of his run, enough to grow weary of the rhythmic clomp of his own boots, the sound of his pained grunts, the noise of his exhausted pants for air. He heard someone say that the last explosion had wrecked the stairway, had impeded the chase, but for how long, and what was the damage? No one knew. Tensions ran high on the landing. The news of McLean's death had unsettled the people of supply. The wounded in yellow coveralls were taken inside, but it was suggested, and not gently, that mechanicals injured would be better off receiving treatment further below, where they belonged. Mark waded through these arguments, the voices still somewhat muffled and distant. He asked everyone about Shirley, several in yellow shrugging as if they didn't know her. One guy said she'd already gone down with some of the other wounded. He said it a second time, louder, before Mark was sure he'd heard him. It was good news, and he figured as much. He was about to leave when his wife emerged without warning from the anxious crowd, startling him. Her eyes widened as she recognized him, and then her gaze fell to his wounded arm. "Oh, God!" She threw her arms around him, pressed her face against his neck. Mark hugged her with one arm, his rifle between them, the barrel cold against his quivering cheek.
"Are you okay?"
he asked. She latched to his neck, her forehead finding his shoulder, and said something he couldn't hear but could feel against his skin. She made room to inspect his arm.
"I can't hear," he told her.
"I'm fine," she said, louder. She shook her head, her eyes wide and wet. I wasn't there. I wasn't there for any of it. Is it true about Knox? What happened? How bad was it? She focused on his wound, and her hands felt good on his arm, strong and confident. The crowd was thinning as members of Mechanical retreated further down the stairwell. Several in Supply Yellow treated Mark to cold stares, eyeing his wound as if worried it would soon be their problem.
Knox is dead, he told her. McLean, too. A few others. I was right there when the blast went off.
He looked down at his arm, which she had exposed by tearing away his ripped and stained undershirt.
Were you shot? She asked.
He shook his head.
I don't know. It happened so fast.
He looked over his shoulder. Where's everyone going? Why aren't we holding up here? Shirley set her teeth and jerked her head at the door, which was too deep with yellow coveralls. Don't think we're wanted, she said, her voice raised so he could hear. I've got to clean this wound. I think some of the bomb is in you.
I'm fine, he insisted. I've just been looking for you. I've been worried sick.
He saw that his wife was crying, unbroken tear tracks standing out amid the beads of sweat.
I thought you were gone, she said.
He had to read her lips to make it out.
I thought they had... that you were...
She bit her lip and stared at him with uncharacteristic fear. Mark had never seen his wife phased, not by a sprung casement leak, not by a cave-in deep in the mine that trapped several of their close friends, not even when Juliet was sent to cleaning. But heaps of dread were locked up in her expression now, and that scared him in a way the bombs and bullets couldn't.
"Let's hurry after the others," he said, taking her hand.
He could feel the exposed nerves on the landing, the gazes begging them to be off. When shouts rang down from above once more, and the members of Supply retreated to the safety of their doorway, Mark knew this brief moment of respite was over. But it was okay. He'd found his wife. She was unharmed. There was little anyone could do to him now. When they reached 139 together, Mark knew they'd made it. His legs had somehow held out. His blood loss hadn't stopped him. With his wife helping him along, they passed the last landing before Mechanical, and all he could think about was holding the line against those bastards who were taking shots at them from above. Inside Mechanical, they would have power, safety in numbers, the advantage of home turf. More importantly, they would be able to bandage wounds and get some rest. That's what he sorely needed. Rest. He nearly tripped and fell down the last few steps, his legs not used to an end to the descent, a flat piece of ground rather than one more tread to sink to. As his knees buckled and Shirley caught him, he finally noticed the jam of people at the security station leading into Mechanical. The crew that had stayed behind while the rest marched up to fight had been busy. Steel plates had been welded solid across the wide security entrance. The diamond-studded sheeting stood from floor to ceiling, wall to wall. Sparks hissed along one edge as someone worked to complete the job from the inside. The sudden flurry of refugees and wounded amassed in a crowd desperate to get in. Mechanics shoved and jostled against the barrier. They screamed and beat on the steel plates, mad with fear.
"What the hell?" Mark cried.
He followed Shirley as she pressed into the back of the crowd. At the front, someone was crawling on the floor, wiggling on their belly through the tightest of gaps, a rectangle left open below the security turnstile wide enough to slide through, easy enough to defend.
"Easy, wait your turn,"
someone ahead of them shouted. Yellow coveralls were mixed in with the others. Some were mechanics who had donned disguises. Some seemed to be from Supply, helping the wounded, mixed up in the wrong crowd or not trusting their own level for safety. As Mark attempted to usher Shirley toward the front, a shot rang out, the thwack and clatter of a hot ball of lead striking nearby. He changed directions and pulled her back toward the stairs. The crush around the impossibly small entrance grew frantic. There was a lot of yelling back and forth through the hole. People on this side shouting that they were being shot at, those on the other side yelling, "One at a time!" Several were on their bellies, scrambling for the tiny hole. One got his arm inside and was pulled through, sliding across the steel grating and disappearing into the dark space. Two others tried to be next, jostling for position. They were all exposed to the open stairwell above. Another shot rang out and someone fell, clutching a shoulder and screaming, "I'm hit!" The throng dispersed. Several ran back to the stairs where the overhang of the treads protected them from the gunfire. The rest were in chaos, all trying to fit through a space expressly designed to allow no more than one at a time. Shirley screamed and squeezed Mark's arm as another person was shot. A mechanic fell to the ground and doubled over in pain. She yelled at her husband, asking them what they should do. Mark dropped his rucksack, kissed her cheek, and ran with his rifle back up the stairs. He tried to take them two at a time, but his legs were too sore. Another shot rang out, the ricochet of a miss. His body felt incredibly heavy, slow, like in a bad dream. He approached the landing of 139 with his gun level, but the shooters were further up, peppering the crowd from higher above. He checked that he had a fresh round in the home-built gun, cocked it, and edged out onto the landing. Several men in the silver of security were leaning out over the railing above, barrels trained down toward the ground floor of mechanical. One of the men tapped his neighbor and pointed toward Mark. Mark watched all this down the length of his own barrel. He fired a shot, and a black rifle tumbled toward him from above, the arms of its wielder slumping over the railing before sagging down and disappearing. Gunfire erupted, but he was already diving back toward the stairs. The shouting grew furious both above and below him. Mark went to the other side of the stairs, away from where he'd last been seen, and peered down. The crowd was thinning by the security barrier. More and more people were being pulled through. He could see Shirley looking up, shielding her eyes against the stairway lights above. Boots rang out behind him. Mark reloaded, turned, and aimed at the highest step he could see along the upward spiral. He waited for whatever was heading down toward him. When the first boot appeared, he steadied himself, allowed more of the man to sink before his barrel, and then he pulled the trigger. Another black rifle clattered against the steps and bounced through the railing. Another man sagged to his knees. Mark turned and ran. He lost his grip on his own gun, felt it bang against his shins as it skittered away from him, and he didn't stop to retrieve it. He slid down the steps, lost his footing, landed on his ass, and bounced back up. He tried taking the steps two at a time, was running as if in a dream, not fast enough, legs like rusted steel. There was a bang, a muffled roar behind him, and somehow someone had caught up, had punched him in the back, had hit him. Mark sprawled forward and bounced down the steps, his chin striking the steel treads. Blood was in his mouth. He tried to crawl, got his feet beneath him, and stumbled forward. Another roar, another punch to the back, the feeling that he'd been bit and kicked at the same time. "This is what it feels like to be shot," he thought, numbly. He spilled down the last few steps, lost sensation in his legs, crashed to the grating. The bottom floor was nearly empty. One person stood beside the tiny hole. Another was half in and half out, boots kicking. Mark saw that it was Shirley, on her belly, looking back at him. They were both lying on the floor. So comfortable on the floor. The steel was cool against his cheek. There were no more steps to run down, no bullets to load, nothing to shoot. Shirley was screaming, not as happy as he was to be lying there. One of her arms extended back out of that small black rectangle, reached for him past the rough cuts in the steel plates. Her body slid forward, pulled by some force beyond, pushed by this nice person in yellow still standing by the strange wall of steel where the entrance to his home used to be. "Go," Mark told her, wishing she wouldn't scream. Blood flecked the floor before him, marking his words. "I love you." And as if by command, her feet slid into the darkness, her screams swallowed by that rectangular, shadowy maw. And the person in yellow turned. The nice man's eyes grew wide, his mouth fell open, and then his body jerked from the violence of gunfire. It was the last thing Mark saw, this man's deathly dance. And he only distantly felt, but for a tremble of time, the end of him that came next. 3 weeks later. Silo 18. Walker remained in his cot and listened to the sounds of distant violence. Shouts echoed down his hallway, emanating from the entrance to mechanical. The familiar patter of gunfire came next, the pop, pop, pop of the good guys, followed by the rat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat of the bad. There was an incredible bang, the roar of blasting powder against steel, and the back-and-forth crackle ended for a moment. More shouting. Boots clumping down his hallway past his door. The boots were the constant beat to the music of this new world, music Walker could hear from his cot. He could hear everything from his cot, even with the blankets drawn over his head, even with his pillow on top, even as he begged, out loud, over and over, for it to please stop. The boots in the hallway carried with them more shouting. Walker curled up into a tight ball, knees against his chest, wondering what time it was, dreading that it was morning, time to get up. A brief respite of silence formed, that quiet of tending to the wounded, their groans too faint to penetrate his sealed door. Walker tried to fall asleep before the music was turned back up, but, as always, the quiet was worse. During the quiet, he grew anxious as he waited for the next patter to erupt. His impatience for sleep often frightened that very sleep away. And he would grow terrified that the resistance was finally over, that the bad guys had won and were coming for him. Someone banged on his door, a small and angry fist, unmistakable to his expert ears. 4 harsh knocks, and then she was gone. Surely. She would have left his breakfast rations in the usual place and taken away last night's picked-over and mostly uneaten dinner. Walker grunted and rolled his old bones over to the other side. Boots clomped, always rushing, always anxious, forever warring. And his once quiet hallway, so far from the machines and pumps that really needed tending to, was now a busy thoroughfare. It was the entrance hall that mattered now, the funnel into which all the hate was poured. Screw the silo, the people above and the machines below. Just fight over this worthless patch of ground, pile the bodies on either side until one gives. Do it because it was yesterday's cause, and because nobody wanted to remember back any further than yesterday. But Walker did. He remembered. The door to his workshop burst open. Through a gap in his filthy cocoon, Walker could see Jenkins, a boy in his 20s but with a beard that made him appear older, a boy who had inherited this mess the moment Knox died. The lad stormed through the maze of workbenches and scattered parts, aiming straight for Walker's cot.
"I'm up,"
Walker groaned, hoping Jenkins would go away.
No, you're not.
Jenkins reached the cot and prodded Walker in the ribs with the barrel of his gun.
Come on, old man, up!
Walker tensed away from him. He wiggled an arm loose to wave the boy away. Jenkins peered down gravely, a frown buried in his beard, his young eyes wrinkled with worry.
We need that radio fixed, Walk. We're getting battered out there, and if I can't listen in, I don't think I can defend this place.
Walker tried to push himself upright. Jenkins grabbed the strap of his coveralls and gave him some rough assistance.
I was up all night on it,
Walker told him. He rubbed his face. His breath was awful.
Is it fixed? We need that radio, Walk. You do know Hank risked his life to get that thing to us, right?
Well, he should have risked a bit more and sent a manual, Walker complained.
He pressed his hands to his knees and, with much complaint from his joints, he stood and staggered toward the workbench, his blankets spilling to the floor in a heap. His legs were still half asleep, his hands tingling with the weak sensation of not being able to form a proper fist.
I got the battery sorted, he told Jenkins. Turns out that wasn't the problem.
Walker glanced toward his open door and saw Harper, a refinery worker turned soldier, standing in the doorway. Harper had become Jenks's number two when Peter was killed. Now he was peering down at Walker's breakfast, practically salivating into it.
Help yourself,
Walker called out. He waved dismissively at the steaming bowl. Harper glanced up, eyes wide, but that was as long as he hesitated. He leaned his rifle against the wall and sat down in the workshop doorway, shoveling food into his mouth. Jenkins grunted disapprovingly but didn't say anything.
So, you see here?
Walker showed him the arrangement on the workbench where various pieces of the small radio unit had been separated and were now wired together so everything was accessible.
I've got constant power.
He patted the transformer he had built to bypass the battery.
And the speakers work.
He keyed the transmission button, and there was a pop and hiss of static from his bench speakers.
But nothing comes through. They aren't saying anything.
He turned to Jenkins.
I've had it on all night, and I'm not a deep sleeper.
Jenkins studied him.
I would have heard, he insisted. They aren't talking.
Jenkins rubbed his face, made a fist. He kept his eyes closed, his forehead resting in one palm, a weariness in his voice.
You think maybe something broke when you tore it apart?
Oh, disassembled, Walker said with a sigh. I didn't tear it apart.
Jenkins gazed up at the ceiling and relaxed his fist.
So you think they aren't using them anymore, is that it? Do you reckon they know we have one? I swear I think this damn priest they sent is a spy. Shit's been falling apart since we let him in here to give last rites.
I don't know what they're doing,
Walker admitted.
I think they're still using the radios, they've just excluded this one somehow. Look, I made another antenna, a stronger one.
He showed him the wires snaking up from the workbench and spiraling around the steel beam rafters overhead. Jenkins followed his finger, then snapped his head toward the door. There was more shouting down the hallway. Harper stopped eating for a moment and listened, but only for a moment. He dug his spoon back into the corn mush.
I just need to know when I'll be able to listen in again.
Jenkins tapped the workbench with his finger, then picked his rifle back up.
I don't need to know about all this.
He waved a hand at Walker's work.
All this wizardry.
Walker plopped down on his favorite stool and peered at the myriad circuits that had once been jammed into the radio's cramped innards.
It's not wizardry, he said. It's electrics.
He pointed at two of the boards, connected by wires he had lengthened and re-soldered so he could analyze all the bits more closely.
I know what most of these do, but you've got to remember that nothing about these devices is known. Not outside of IT, anyway. I'm having to theorize while I tinker.
Jenkins rubbed the bridge of his nose.
Just let me know when you've got something. All your other work orders can wait. This is the only thing that matters. Got that?
Walker nodded. Jenkins turned and barked at Harper to get the hell off the floor. They left Walker on his stool, their boots picking up the beat of the music again. Alone, he stared down at the machine strung out across his workbench, its little green lights on its mysterious boards lit up and taunting him. His hand drifted to his magnifiers, as if by their own accord, as if by decades of habit, when all Walker really wanted was to crawl back into his cot, to wrap his cocoon around himself, to disappear. He needed help, he thought. He looked around at all that required doing, and, as ever, his thoughts turned to Scotty, his little shadow. There had been a slice of time, somewhere sliding away from him now, and fading into the slippery past, where Walker had been a happy man, where his life should have ended to keep him from enduring any of the suffering beyond. But he had made it through that brief bliss and now could hardly recall it. He couldn't imagine what it felt like to rise with anticipation in the morning, to fall asleep with contentment at the end of every day. It was only fear and dread anymore, and between, regret. He had started all of this, all the noise and violence. Walker was convinced of that. Every life lost was on his wrinkled hands. Every tear shed was by his actions. Nobody said it, but he could feel them thinking it. One little message to supply, one favor for Juliet, just a chance at dignity, an opportunity to test her wild and horrible theory, to bury herself out of sight. And now, look at the cascade of events, the eruption of anger, the senseless violence. It wasn't worth it, he decided. This was how the math always added up. Not worth it. Nothing seemed worth it anymore. He bent over his workbench and set his old hands to tinkering. This was what he did, what he had always done. There was no escaping it now. No stopping those fingers with their papery skin, those palms with their deep lines that seemed to never end, not when they should. He followed those lines down to his bony wrists, where weak little veins ran like buried wire with blue insulation. One snip, and off he goes to see Scotty, to see Juliet. It was tempting. Especially since Walker figured, wherever they were, whether the priests were onto something or simply rat-shit mad, he figured both of his old friends were in far better places than he. 4. Silo 17. A tiny strand of copper wire stood at right angles to the rest. It was like a silo landing, shooting off the great stairway, a bit of flat amid the twisted spiral. As Juliet wrapped the pads of her fingers around the wire and worked the splice into place, this jutting barb sank into her finger, stinging her like some angry insect. Juliet cursed and shook her hand. She very nearly dropped the other end of the wire, which would have sent it tumbling several levels down. She wiped the welling spot of blood onto her gray coveralls, then finished the splice and secured the wires to the railing to keep the strain off. She still didn't see how they had come loose, but everything in this cursed and dilapidated silo seemed to be coming apart. Her senses were the least of it. She leaned far out over the railing and placed her hand on the hodgepodge of pipes and tubing fastened to the concrete wall of the stairwell. She tried to discern, with hands chilled by the cool air of the deep, any vibration from water gurgling through the pipe.
"Anything?"
she called down to Solo. There seemed to be the slightest tremor in the plastic tubing, but it could have been her pulse rather than its.
"I think so!"
Solo's thin voice echoed from far below. Juliet frowned and peered down the dimly lit shaft, down that gap between steel step and thick concrete. She would have to go see for herself. leaving her small tool bag on the steps. No danger of anyone coming along to trip over it. She took the treads two at a time and spiraled her way deeper into the silo. The electrical wiring on the long snake of pipe spun into view with each rotation, drips of purple adhesive marking every laborious joint she'd cut and fastened by hand. Other wiring ran alongside hers, electrical cables snaking from IT far above to power the grow lights of the lower farms. Juliet wondered who had rigged this stuff up. It hadn't been Solo. This wiring had been strung during the early days of Silo 17's downfall. Solo had simply become the lucky beneficiary of someone else's hard and desperate work. Grow lights now obeyed their timers. The greenery obeyed the urge to blossom, and beyond the stale stench of oil and gas, of floods and unmoving air, the ripe tinge of plants growing out of control could be nosed from several landings away. Juliet stopped at the landing of 136, the last dry landing before the flood. Solo had tried to warn her, had tried to tell her even as she lusted over the image of the massive diggers on the wall-size schematic. Hell, she should have known about the flood without being told. Groundwater was forever seeping into her own silo, a hazard of living below the water table. Without power to the pumps, the water would naturally make its way in and rise. Out on the landing, she leaned on the steel railing and caught her breath. A dozen steps below, Solo stood on the single dry tread their efforts had exposed.